Well, scientists at the University of Cambridge and Johns Hopkins University have just mapped the most complex brain to date, that of a fruit fly. This breakthrough research on the insect brain may give us many clues about how the human brain works. Not only that, but it could help us understand what drives our social behaviour. And it opens up the potential to even rewire the brain to address disorders. It's groundbreaking work, and Dr. Michael Winding, the group leader of the Brain Mapping Project, joins us now. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, our pleasure. Where shall we start? Can we start with the Francis Crick Institute and the work that's taking place there?
Yeah, so I should mention that this work was mostly done at the University of Cambridge. And out of this work, I've now started my own group at the Francis Crick Institute. And there we're going to be studying how animals engage in social interactions. And we're going to be using this brain map as kind of the basis for that.
Very good. So the brain map, how did it begin?
Yeah, so it has a long history, in fact. It even predates me. So this project began at Howard Hughes Medical Institute, Genalia Research Campus, about 10 or more years ago. And the idea was that in the past, people have been interested in generating these brain maps to understand how brains function, because brains are really collections of interconnected brain cells or neurons. And to understand what brains are doing, we need to see how electrical signals are sent throughout the brain across those neurons. And that's really the basis of how we think, how we do all the things that we do. And so in the past, people have mapped very small invertebrates, so worms, sea squirts, animals that have just a few hundred brain neurons. And so about 10 years ago, the technology had gotten to the stage where we could now map even larger and more complex brains. And so we used electron microscopy to actually image the entire brain of a fruit fly larva. And this animal has over 3,000 brain neurons. So it's a step up in complexity. And so how you actually do this is you have to actually slice the brain into, in our case, about 5,000 slices. You take each of these slices, put it under an electron microscope. And what that allows you to do is now image this animal with such magnification that you can see individual synapses or connections between individual neurons, as well as all neurons across the entire brain. And then after this stage, you go through the years-long process of actually reconstructing those individual neurons, mapping all those individual synapses, until at the end you have an entire map of the brain. And that process took about 11 person years to complete.
Gracious me. Okay, and at which point in the 11 years did you come into the work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I started about 6.5 years ago on this project, and I contributed to about 3 years of this 11-year reconstruction bit. And then after that, I was kind of the research lead on analyzing this brain and trying to make some kind of sense of it and what can we do with it.
So before we get into what you found, could you speak to the challenges of mapping the human brain so we can sort of make that segue eventually? Fingers crossed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a great question. So this brain was extremely complicated to map and extremely labor intensive. And this brain has about 3,000 neurons and 500,000 synaptic sites, which is significantly more than what came before, about 300 neurons, 10,000 synaptic sites. However, the human brain is completely different. Instead of 3,000 neurons, you now have over 80 billion neurons. And instead of 500,000 synaptic sites, you now have over 100 trillion synaptic sites. And so the orders of magnitude is just staggering. And so with current technology today, we don't even have the ability to map a tiny, tiny fraction of that brain, the human brain. And so this is why we need to take these stepping stones along the way of these smaller and more complex brains and build into that eventually.
So mapping the brain of the fruit fly is a stepping stone towards mapping the human brain. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So as we build these technologies by mapping these smaller brains, we can eventually map larger and larger brains. So after this one, this is the larva of the fruit fly. What I would expect to come next is the adult fruit fly, and then after that, the next larger animal. However, it is really important to now study these smaller ones as well, because I think we're at a really nice turning point here with the fruit fly larva, where this animal, unlike the smaller animals that have been mapped, this one, it really has brain structures that look like a human brain. So it has two brain hemispheres. It has a brain stem-like structure. It even has a structure called the ventral nerve cord, which is really just like our spinal cord. And so you can follow sensory signals into the brain, and the brain will do processing and send out behavioral signals to the spinal cord equivalent, where they then activate different muscles. And so it has that same flow of information. Additionally, this animal has many of the same brain structures. So as a memory and learning structure, it makes decisions about its environment and it engages in social behavior. So it has many of the same problems that the brain has to solve as we do as humans. And so I think there's a lot we can learn from it.
What are you discovering so far in terms of social interaction?
Yeah, so that's kind of where I'd like to go next with this. So all animals engage in social interactions, and they're really important for animal survival. And in humans, of course, they're important for many, many phenomenons. So we structure our societies based on social interactions, locally and then more globally. And many of the phenomenon that humans do that animals don't, such as art, and many technological innovations such as the internet and social media and social networking platforms. These are all based on social interactions. And to really understand social interactions, we need to understand what parts of the brain are driving these social interactions and how do brains and animals interact with each other. And so you can only really study this in a detailed way where you understand the mechanism of how social interaction happens by having such a brain map.
So we've got the brain map now of the fruit fly larvae. What are you finding from the social interactions of the fruit fly that can be directly applied to humans at this stage?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a future direction, but so it's known that larvae engage in cooperative behavior. So they'll help each other forage for food. So they live in a substrate of food, and they'll kind of just feed independently. And as the nutrients on the top of that layer of food are depleted, the animals will make a decision to come together, help each other all dig deeper and access more nutrient-rich food. And each individual animal has to make the decision whether to cooperate or not to cooperate, to act competitively. And this is something that these are decisions humans make all the time. And each individual animal, each larva in this case, has to make that decision for themselves. Do I want to cooperate and help my peers, or is there too much of a disadvantage for me? And then that larva can choose to cooperate or not to cooperate. Additionally, it's also been shown that in the fruit fly larva, if you socially isolate this animal during its development while it's being reared, that you find that these animals are unable to later engage in cooperative behaviors effectively. And so what I'd like to do in the future is take this brain map that we have and then compare it to brain maps that we're going to map in the future of socially isolated animals and see how does brain wiring physically change in those brains and how can that explain how socially isolated animals have disrupted social interactions with their peers.
What a question. So, just thinking about other animals' brains, what other animals' brains have been mapped prior to the fruit fly?
Yeah, so the first one was the C. elegans. This is a small roundworm. It has about 300 neurons across the whole nervous system, actually. And this was mapped in 1986 by Sydney Brenner, in fact. So this was kind of the first connectome, and it was way before its time. The technology wasn't really there to utilize it or understand it. And there haven't been many connectomes until much more recently. And now we have another marine worm As well as a sea squirt. And these have all come out over the last 5 years or so. So we're really at this inflection point where I think connectomes and these brain maps are going to start taking off in an exponential kind of way. And so this is the most recent, largest brain. And I expect that over the next few years, you're going to start seeing more and more.
So, I mean, I'm just still marveling at these numbers, right? The fruit fly has 3,000 neurons, but the human being has 80 billion. Yeah,
that's quite
a difference, huh? So can you just talk us through the process of scientifically mapping a brain?
Yeah, so there's many ways of doing it. So the current technology, as I mentioned before, is essentially slicing up a brain and imaging it with an electron microscope. But to actually map it now, what we've developed in our group is computational tools, particularly a software suite that we call CatMade for collaborative annotation of neurons. And what you do is you use this software to actually look at that microscopy data and identify which bits are individual neurons, and then you click onto those bits and you kind of annotate them, go along, build up the entire shape of individual neurons, and that's another bit of data we get out of these brain maps. So you have the individual shapes of all 3,000 neurons, and then as you go along, you also identify these synaptic sites, so these connections between individual neurons throughout that brain map, and in this way you get a networked wiring diagram that's a bit like, you could think of it like a Facebook network. So all of your friends within Facebook, in the brain map, what you'll have is each individual neuron will have all of its connection partners within the brain. And by looking at this network, you can kind of figure out what different parts of the brain might be doing.
Is technology able to keep up with what you're wanting it to keep up with?
Yes, I think so. So for our brain map, we had a semi-automated or a computer-assisted reconstruction technique. And that, as I mentioned, took about 11 years to reconstruct this brain. But technology has moved quickly. And now people are using automated reconstruction. So this is using artificial intelligence and machine learning to actually identify these individual neurons, reconstruct them, also identify the synaptic sites. And this is really revolutionizing the field. And so in this way, what took 11 years now, I think in the future will take the matter of months. Additionally, the actual imaging of the brains, it took us about a year and a half to image this single brain using electron microscopy. But new techniques developed by groups at Genalia Research Campus allow us to now image an exact same brain like this in 2 weeks instead of a year and a half. So the technology is greatly improving. And as these speeds increase, we can tackle larger and larger brains.
Have you found any similarities with the mapping the fruit fly brain and AI or artificial intelligence?
Yeah, this is something that we looked at, and we actually found some surprising similarities, which is quite interesting. One thing we found was that despite having 3,000 neurons and 500,000 synaptic sites, this brain was actually surprisingly shallow. And what I mean by that is when you look at the senses that come into the brain, so touch, taste, smell, for instance, these inputs into the brain, it only takes them about 6 layers of neurons before it gets to the outputs of the brain that determine which behaviors the animal should take. And when I saw this, I was quite surprised. And so I started digging into it a bit more. And what I found is that there was actually short pathways from the brain input to output, but layered on top of these short pathways were longer and longer pathways. And this was very reminiscent of a state-of-the-art artificial intelligence architecture, which is called the ResNet, where it also has this layered structure. And what it's thought to do is allow shallow networks, like our brain here, to actually outcompete deeper networks. Additionally, we also found looping connections. So there's many loops within the brain, and this is called recurrence. And in artificial intelligence, there are also recurrent artificial neural nets. And these are thought to allow networks to kind of adjust their depth depending on how complicated the task they're trying to perform is. And so it's quite interesting that we found these architectures within a biological brain that's matching many of the state-of-the-art architectures in artificial intelligence. So it seems that evolution has taken millions and millions of years to build these efficient brain architectures. And it's quite interesting that our last several decades of artificial intelligence research has kind of honed in on the same architectures.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So with the mapping of the fruit fly larvae brain, what happens with that research? How will it be used, or how is it being used to help humans thus far?
Yeah, so I think that the primary thing that it's going to be useful for is using the brain as a reference to then compare to other perturbations of brain. So for instance, in the larva, in fruit flies generally, many of the genes are conserved between humans and fruit flies, meaning they serve similar roles, they have similar sequences. And so what this allows us to do is we can mutate genes in the fruit fly that are related to neurological disorders such as autism, schizophrenia, epilepsy in humans, and then see how does it change brain wiring. And when we kind of get an assessment of how this wiring changes, we can see where does it change, which might allow us to target treatments to certain brain regions. And it can also tell us, we can also kind of try rewiring the brain in the future using future technologies that unfortunately don't yet exist in humans. But gene therapy, for instance, would be one avenue that would be of interest in the future, I would say.
So what happens next for you, your research?
Yeah, that's right. So for me, this is kind of the exact direction I'd like to go in. See, how does brain wiring change due to social isolation, mutation of genes, and how does this affect social behaviors? And can we, by activating or inactivating certain brain regions that are affected by these perturbations, can we restore those social behaviors to kind of a normal level? Additionally, this is only a single brain map, and it's hard to tease apart which part of this brain map are due to individual specific brain wiring to this particular animal that we've mapped, and which are kind of general. So we'd also like to map many different brains in the future and then see which parts are responsible for individual differences or idiosyncrasies in different animals, and which are kind of the actual kind of general brain structures.
To close, Michael, I'm interested at the level that you're working, such deep research. What's the process with your findings that allow them to eventually be applied to humans? How does that part work? How long does that take? I'm just thinking it's taken an 11 something years to map this brain. What, you know, when would we expect to see the impacts of your research in our healthcare, for example?
That's right. So I think this is a great question just for basic research in general, particularly biomedical research. And I think for many of these things, there has to be a level of faith, but you can look in the past at how it's gone. But typically what happens is you need basic understanding of how something works. Like, how does a brain work? And how does the brain get changed in different disease states, even in a simple organism? And then the next group may start looking in, say, mouse, for instance, and see if they can see similar changes, similar effects. And they'll give them a huge clue of where to look, because even the mouse, for instance, has 10 million or so neurons. And so that's non-trivial to see where are changes there. And so the next group will kind of follow up on our findings. And then eventually you can have a translational group that will try looking for actual therapies that could be useful for different disease states. So I would say throughout basic science, you can't get to those stages where you start looking at clinical application if you don't just understand how the systems work to begin with. And so generally, I think funding basic research is very important, although you can't pinpoint exactly how long it will be until we have treatments. We will never get to treatments if we don't understand the systems to begin with.
So good speaking with you. Thank you. Fascinating topic, and all the very best with your work.
Thank you very much. And I'd also like to just mention a huge thank you to my group leader during this project, Marta Zlatic, as well as Albert Cardona. Without them and their advice, this would have never happened.
No, well done. Thank you for mentioning them too. It's definitely a group effort over a prolonged period of time.
That's
and
right.
So important that we all also learn and understand that. Thanks so much, Michael.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Enjoy Friday.